Hooligan Radio.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. On this program, I'm going to speak about the feudal system, the el sistema feudal, the feudal system. This is in response to a letter from a listener who was unclear about the concept, the idea of being a vassal or being a lord. What did that imply? I mentioned on an earlier program that the feudal system was not completely practiced in most of Spain, and especially in the Kingdom of Castile. And I'll go on to explain what I mean by that. But let's talk about what it meant. Now, imagine that you have to, you're going to become a vassal, a feudal vassal. Vassal just means servant. Latin was vassalis. And you're going to be a servant. You are going to be the king's man. And from man, we get homage. That's what it means. Homenaje, homage, from the word for man. You are the king's man. Now, that would involve a ceremony of sort of installation. You would be installed as duke or count or then a duke or a count could install you at a lower rank in the system. Theoretically, it was all hierarchical. Now, the root of this idea is that the entire country belongs to the king. It is the property of the king. And no land exists outside of the property of the king. You hold it for the king, but it is not yours. Now, the king can give it to whoever he wants and gives it in exchange for some kind of recompense, some kind of reward. The king is the overlord, and you take possession. Again, you are installed. You take possession of this land in a ceremony. You kneel, no, arrodillarse. You kneel before the king, and you put your hands inside his hands. That was a big part of the ceremony. And this idea of putting your hands together, that's absolutely part of the, again, the idea of obedience, of servility, of humility. And so this idea of putting your hands together today is how people pray. People go to Christian churches, put their hands together, and pray. Well, that is actually not coming from Christianity itself. That actually comes from feudalism, from this custom, again, toward the beginning of the millennium, toward the 10th century, where feudalism, where homage, where this this idea of becoming a vassal, where all of that originated. In the breakup of the Carolingian Empire, you got, chaos everywhere. And this was the system that evolved out of it, part from Roman custom, part from barbarian custom, the Germanic customs, from el derecho consuetudinario, right, from common law, and part simply evolved in practice. Okay, after you put your hands together, as if you were praying, and you put those hands in the king's hands, remember that at this point, the king can grab both of your hands, and you are absolutely helpless, right? Indefenso. Indefenso ante el rey. He can grab your hands, and he can do anything he wants to you. In other words, this is a demonstration of your vulnerability. Next, you need some kind of a transcendental way to identify this, some way to make sure that nobody's lying. Now, that would involve a relic, especially good, a holy relic, something that had a proven track record of miraculous events, something that you absolutely knew was connected to things out of this world, connected to the divine, like, well, relics, parts of the bodies of saints. These were really, really important in the Middle Ages because everybody knew that they were magic. They transcended time and space, and so they were important. So you put your hand on a relic, or if you don't have one by default, right, por defecto, on one of the sacred writings, the Gospels or something, then you have fealty. Fealty, loyalty. A fealty is an old word. Today we might say fidelity. But fealty was an oath, un juramento, right? An oath that you are going to serve the Lord, your Lord, faithfully. Then the king gives his new vassal a piece of earth, right? I believe that was a gleba in Spanish, gleba. In any case, a piece of earth and traditionally part of a tree, maybe a branch from a tree. And this symbolized that the vassal was installed, was now in possession of the land for which he had done homage. So, normally it was a very special people who received this directly from the king himself. Normally, you would have sort of vassals of vassals. You would go lower down in the ranks, and there would be a similar ceremony. Knights, for example, and all the way down to minor aristocrats, the equivalent of, I don't know, infanzones, caballeros, right? Knights. And your duty after that is to provide your master with a certain number of soldiers, perhaps a certain number of horses in times of war. Another of these obligations were called aids from ayudas, right? Aids, money, and on four occasions, on four special occasions, the Lord had to be given presents, had to receive these gifts, these aids. Firstly, when the eldest son becomes a knight, if the king is going to make your eldest son a knight, in that case, you've got to give him a little present, one of these aids. The marriage of the eldest daughter And that was absolutely essential that the king receive his cut, his part, his share. Now, in the time of the Crusades, there was an extra one of these aides that was destined toward the funding of the Crusade, a special one. Later on, of course, all of this was institutionalized, and practically every church in Europe had to pay a tax for the Crusades. I believe that was instituted, I think it was by Pope Innocent III. I think it was for the Fourth Crusade. But in any case, there was a special crusading tax in addition to this aid for the departure of a crusade. And if your king is taken captive, if he is alive and has been held as a hostage, rehén, if he is a hostage, you are going to have to pay the rescate. It is part of your duty, part of your feudal duty, part of your fealty, to pay his ransom, el rescate. Now, also there's the advice. If your lord needs advice, you are under obligation to go and give him that advice. Tell him what to do. Now, of course, this was the ideal system. There were variations, and especially in a place like Castile, on the, let's call it the border, on the front, in a sort of a war, a crusade, the whole idea of the Reconquista, everything got confused here. And so after, for example, after the Battle of Las Navas de Tolosa, when there was enormous territory opening up, it was very, very difficult for people to expect to live up to these obligations. Even earlier, in a place like Castile, a kind of a no man's land, quite often that was settled, right, by colonizado, settled by people who did have the right to own their land. And in Castile, occasionally, you had the right of beatria, the people there could choose the person that they wanted as a lord. In other words, lords would have to compete with each other in order to give good conditions. And in many cases, you also had ecclesiastical arrangements where people living in one territory had a totally different system of rights and duties from people living next door in the next territory. So yes, it was anything but uniform, anything but hierarchical. And as I say, it was not practiced in most of Spain the way it was, the ideal way that I'm describing here. In theory, at least ideally, the vassal was only in possession of his feudo, of his fief. That's what we call it in English, a fief. Only in possession for his lifetime. However, that doesn't motivate anybody, right? Practically everybody has dynastic pretensions. And you want to sacrifice so that your children have better opportunities. Well, in fact, fiefs descended from father to son. And again, with ownership, with at least theoretically, this idea of primogeniture. Primogeniture or primogeniture is when the eldest son gets everything. Now, as we have seen from Spanish history, a lot of times that just didn't happen, at least certainly among the Christian kingdoms of Spain. You had many instances in which, against tradition, going against all tradition, going against, for example, what the Visigoths did in their day, you would have a king who simply divided up his land and gave it to his various children, to his sons, who in turn tried to take it back from each other. This is the father trying to make peace among his sons when in fact he is simply inviting them to practice fratricide. You see it again and again. Well, in at least in its pure state, feudalism involved primogeniture. And so it went from father to son, leaving the younger children with really no option except to fight somewhere else. I mean, that's one of the reasons the Crusades were created in the first place, to provide a channel, to provide an outlet for younger brothers. And obviously, the church was another option. Again, many of the people who did not inherit went into the church. And of course, if the elder son happened to die, then the younger son, who was a member of the church, quite often a member of the high clergy, was expected to give it all up and go back, reclaim his land, and live as if that parenthesis in his life had never happened. This was, of course, very, very difficult, but it was considered part of your duty back then. Now, after Charlemagne's empire began to break up, it was divided into three parts. It began to break up, and until the time of Otón Primero, Otto the First, until the time of Otto the First, the whole project was not reconstituted. It was absolute chaos. Small landowners were at the mercy of the bigger ones. You had barons, you had knights marauding. Anybody who commanded 10 men would go and fight anybody who commanded only 5 men, kill them, take their cattle, take whatever they had, and use it to increase your size. I mean, this is going back to the old days, the very, very primitive times of pre-civilized times, let's call it that, the times of the Copper Age, and during the earliest Neolithic times, this is what people did. They stole each other's cattle. They stole each other's horses, and they were not in a condition to defend land, but this is how they spent their time. I mean, the los Iberos, or I don't know, the beginnings of ancient Greece, you have all of these stories of cattle thieves. And yes, this is what Europe had degenerated into by the time that feudalism was instituted. You can imagine there was very little place in this system, a free-for-all, you can imagine, a very little place for somebody who wasn't well-connected, somebody belonging to a minority, an ethnic minority, a religious minority. If you couldn't count on important friends to defend you, then that was going to be the end. So, the advantage of the feudal system, it didn't cost the king that much. The king did not have to have a large infrastructure to defend his own lands, or have to have a standing army, raise an army. And he could always call on his vassals, and they, in turn, called on their vassals. And in that way, again, the king could defend himself unless... we're going to see later there are cases where the king is excommunicated by the Pope, where he has very few friends and nobody is supposed to obey his oath of obedience. Nobody is supposed to practice the fealty that the system depends on if the king has been excommunicated. Now, there were variations. For example, William the Conqueror understood the system of fealty, the feudal system, very, very well. He descended from Vikings. The Vikings came down as the Northmen. However, Rollo, the chief Viking who landed in that area, he made a deal with the French king to be his vassal. And within just a couple of generations, what you had was a stable feudal system. These people changed immediately. It's a total transformation from Vikings in just a couple of generations to French-speaking knights. And very well connected, as I say, with the French king and with the Pope. Because William the Conqueror, there in Normandy, given to the Normans, in Normandy, he will not invade England without the Pope's blessing, without the green light. And naturally the Pope approved. The Pope did not like the English king at this time. And so the invasion took place. Once it was complete, once the Normans were in control of England, well, this time it was going to be different. On an earlier program, I talked about the great census that they undertook. They had taken over England and most of Ireland. They didn't know what they had. And so they had an exhaustive census, village by village, town by town, field by field, to see exactly how much they owned. All of this is, of course, of invaluable service to historians. The Domesday Book, it still exists. There is a copy of the Domesday Book. And the other thing they did was to give out different parts in a feudal arrangement. Now, William understood that he was almost as powerful as the King of France. And maybe with this combination of Normandy and Britain, he was more powerful than the King of France. And in a few generations, with the Angevins, you're going to see that England believes that large parts of France belong to England. Well, William was not going to make the same mistake, and so when he divided out the different parts, when he made vassals of the Normans in this new land, he made absolutely sure that each and every one of them only had a little, that he tried to stop any effort at consolidation, so that the king was the undisputed master of this new country. All right, I have to take a short break now, but I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Ah, Platón, amigo, déjame hablarte de la paradoja del ejecutivo con el lengua.
¿La qué, Aristóteles?
En el futuro, todas las mujeres y hombres importantes de la Tierra necesitarán comunicarse en la misma lengua para prosperar en sus trabajos, o de lo contrario, no podrán ascender y obtener grandes ganancias. Esa lengua se llamará inglés.
Ajá, lo comprendo, querido Aristóteles, pero sus trabajos y el quehacer cotidiano mantendrán a los hombres y a las mujeres ocupados, y no tendrán tiempo de aprender el foráneo lenguaje. He ahí la paradoja.
Este es tu máster. Infórmate llamando al 91-133-5833. Y recuerda, también disponible en Valencia y Barcelona. Conoce más sobre el máster. Apúntate a la próxima sesión informativa en Madrid, Valencia y Barcelona.
Inglés Gramática Fácil Ejercicios es un libro de autoestudio que está pensado para acompañar a nuestro bestseller Inglés Gramática Fácil. El libro trabaja desde las estructuras más básicas hasta las más complejas a través de ejercicios clásicos de Vaughan, como la traducción inversa, la formación de preguntas y respuestas o la práctica de oraciones afirmativas, negativas e interrogativas. También incluye ejercicios clásicos como completar o unir frases. Su estructura sigue el orden de Inglés Gramática Fácil, libro de referencia de gramática de Vaughan Systems, por lo que Inglés Gramática Fácil Ejercicios es perfecto para consolidar lo aprendido. Incluye más de 700 ejercicios escritos, así como 180 ejercicios enfocados en el listening. Incluye audio descargable en MP3.
Consíguelo en nuestras tiendas Vaughan o en grupovaughan.com.
Lo peor en la vida no es no cumplir todos los sueños, lo peor es no tener sueños que cumplir. Dicho de otro modo, si ponemos el listón muy alto, pues quizá no lleguemos a ese listón, pero podremos estar esforzándonos. Tenemos que soñar con organizaciones en las que nosotros, seamos directivos o seamos empleados, estamos dando lo mejor de nosotros mismos, porque eso va precisamente en nuestra ventaja. Nosotros nos vamos haciendo con nuestros comportamientos.
Si quieres descubrir las claves del éxito de la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado, no te pierdas las dos nuevas convocatorias del seminario Emprender y Liderar, las claves del éxito. El jueves 27 de septiembre o el jueves 25 de octubre de 16:30 a 20:30 horas en Áncora, Madrid, calle Trafalgar 6. Solicita más información en grupovaughan.com/seminario.
No importa lo que hayas estudiado, no importa a qué te quieras dedicar. Hagas lo que hagas, vas a necesitar el inglés. Haz un máster que realmente merezca la pena. Haz el máster en inglés profesional de Vaughan. Más información en el 91-133-5833 o en grupovaughan.com. Máster en inglés profesional.
Además, ahora financiate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupovaughan.com.
¿Alguna vez has pensado en todo lo que puedes llegar a conseguir? Alcanzar todas tus metas, todas las oportunidades laborales al alcance de tu mano. EMEP, un programa en inglés para ejecutivos y profesionales de alto rendimiento a tiempo parcial durante 5 meses. Este es tu máster. Infórmate llamando al 91-133-5833. Y recuerda, también disponible en Valencia y Barcelona. Conoce más sobre el máster. Apúntate a la próxima sesión informativa en Madrid, Valencia y Barcelona.
Además, ahora financiate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones
condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupobaugan.com.
Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was speaking about the feudal system. I was speaking about this idea where you had a king or some kind of feudal lord, and under that king, you had vassals with a system of recognition, with a ceremony of installation as vassal, and a system of rights, of privileges, and of duties that you had to perform. And how, just before the break, I was talking about how in Britain, after the Norman invasion, the new king, the Norman kings, the new dynasty, how they were successfully able to control things so that nobody really had too much power. Later on, of course, there is going to be a process of consolidation. You're going to have very big families that are able to challenge the established royal order. And all of this toward the end of the Middle Ages, all of this is going to break down into a civil war, the War of the Roses. And, but that's all, what, that's all 400 years in the future. For a while, it worked. Very interesting what happened in Ireland. Ireland, you did have a system of clans there, and you had these clans under a founder, under usually some sort of mythical founder, quite often in Irish, as last names, right, as apellidos. You can hear echoes, you can hear vestiges of the way it was. The beginning with O, for example, O'Brien, or O'Flanagan, or O'Donnell, all of these things that indicated a belonging to a certain clan. Now, under the new system, you have the same idea, but instead, remember that the Normans spoke French. Instead of this O, or instead of the instead of the system in Scotland, where the clan's name often began with Mick, MacDonald, MacArthur, Mick, etc., here they chose the French word fils, son. So yes, the son of, that would be fils. And very quickly, that changed, it sort of deformed into Fitz. So yes, Fitzpatrick, Fitzgerald, Fitz, all of these names beginning with Fitz indicate that the, again, the origin is from Norman times, from the Norman invasion. Now, within the fief, every feudal lord had the power of life or death over his vassals. judge and jury, he was undisputed. And he, of course, was the only one able to choose when to make war and against who. A private war was his right. And you could and often did make war on your neighbor for any pretext. The resulting destruction, death, and so forth, meant that by the end of the millennium, things were really, really bad. And yes, the level of destruction, chaos, and darkness at the end of the first millennium, by the year 1000, it was really without precedence in the Western world. However, if you belong to one of these aristocratic families, one of these families that fought, then there was really no other profession open to you. Making war is what you did. You fight, you die. That is your purpose in life. Of course, at the lowest level, you do find siervos de la gleba, right? You find serfs, slaves, villains. The word says it all. Villain in English is el malo de la película, right? A villain is somebody so debased and low and without any virtue whatsoever. A villain. Well, that comes from bieno, somebody who lives in a town. Now, if the king chose to change around his different fiefs, then the vassals, the servants, the villains, and the serfs went with it. They were property. They could neither marry or do really anything else without his permission. At the same time, I mean, there were obligations. He had to work the master's land, or he had to a couple of weeks or a couple of months per year was spent exclusively working for his feudal lord, not for himself. He, if he did his duty, the lord had absolutely no right to take his land from him, but at the same time, at least theoretically, did have decisions, life or death power. It was, the serf really had no more right than a cow. By the way, this idea, this popular idea that many people have of the pernada, right? We call it first night in English. The pernada, we really don't know. It might have been a ceremony in which the feudal lord simply puts his foot or his leg on the bed of the couple getting married. That's what the word pernada actually comes from. That pierna, it comes from that. Now, there of course were references to it in the Middle Ages. But it seems not to have been practiced very often. I mean, there is a case in Afuero in Spain. It says que nos den como ha sido costumbre hasta ahora una pata And that is obviously a reference to la pernada, o pernocta. In the 15th century, in Catalonia, there was a rebellion against the Remeses, one of the demands was that they stop this practice. And in Catalonia, the Lord said, "We have never ever demanded anything like that. You're accusing us of practices that don't exist." Yeah. In any case, there were all sorts of strange customs practiced really until recently about newlyweds and about weddings and the result of weddings. For example, the fertility that is supposed to come out of a newlywed couple, that fertility could be transferred. So in many cases, I know this happened in Galicia until the 20th century. In Galicia, you could actually pay a newlywed couple to go out on your land and practice the thing they do after they get married. And the idea would be that this enthusiasm, this fertility, this good luck would transfer and make the land more fertile. In any case, this was, yes, the pernada was really not a thing in the Middle Ages. However, you did have other duties that I was talking about, the need to work and so forth. And then, after that, when things did become stable, centuries later, in the 12th and 13th century, you had a population explosion. There was more food, and there was a kind of Malthusian result. Lots and lots of people, lots and lots of opportunities as well. Everywhere in Europe, land is cleared and new places are established with new feudal rights, presumably more lenient than before. But yes, all over Europe, you have places called New Town, Villeneuve, right? Via Nueva, all over Europe. And this happens, and the land is cleared. I mean, deforestation happens. And yes, you have a huge population boom. And then things go bad. Then there's a kind of a mini climate change. And again, one of these Malthusian disasters where all of a sudden there isn't enough food to feed all these people. And in the first quarter of the 14th century, you get the plague. After the bubonic plague begins to devastate Europe, and especially these new places, especially places that were hyper-populated, once these areas are devastated, and we still don't know, I mean, in some areas, people estimate, and these are only estimates, some people estimate one-third of the population. Other people, three-quarters of the population destroyed, vanished, gone. And you have many of these new towns that are swallowed up in reforestation, where the land goes back to the way it was. In just a couple of generations, nature takes over again. We don't know about many of these, or we haven't known about many of these places until relatively recently, until the medieval archaeology was able to estimate the extent to which the population and civilization had grown. Because all of that, after the plague, all of that went back to nature as if mankind had never been there. Now, once so many people had died, once all of these people were gone, it was going to be very, very difficult to establish the way of life that had been prominent before. Feudalism was not viable in its pure form after the plague. And they found other ways, means of taxation, other ways that were, that gave a certain economic vitality to the society. That with money, you didn't have to, you didn't have to do this, you didn't have to do that. You could use a few coins instead of working for the feudal lord. And all of this evolved into a sort of a tax system that gradually replaced the system of feudal duties that had been so prevalent before the plague. Now, in this system, yeah, you had, as I say, so many aristocrats that who lived for fighting, who did nothing more than fight. Well, what happened when they couldn't? When they couldn't, they had pretend battles, mimics battles, called tournaments. You would see these people dressed up as finely as they could dress, each man in full armor, as if this were real war, but with the weapons, weapons that didn't serve as well, right? Swords that didn't cut. Let's put it that way. And you would have these men on horseback jousting, la justa, jousting with each other, not to kill, but to knock the other man off his horse. Now, this is important because the fact is that in battle, in medieval times, in battle, your enemy was worth more to you off his horse than he was dead. If you had a prominent enemy, what you really wanted was ransom money, right? El rescate. He was worth much more alive than dead. You really weren't, in a medieval battle, you weren't really trying to kill the enemy. Just capture him. Because money was always scarce, and it was much better to count on that el rescate, the ransom, than extract that money from your own lands. Now, in the 12th century, we have a testimony from London saying that the young men held pseudo-tournaments. I'm calling them pseudo-tournaments because these weren't real knights. These were simply townspeople. Young men, they could be knights in training, right? You started out as a page, right? A paje, a page, And then you graduated into becoming a squire, escudero. And finally, you became a knight, page, squire, and knights. Well, you have lots of pages, lots of squires, and lots of opportunities for these to play at war. And so the line of young men, that's what he calls it, they take the field after dinner. And by dinner, he means lunch. They take the field after dinner, mounted on horses of the very best quality. Now, they are equipped with lances and with shields. Even the younger ones have javelins. They pretend that they are at war. This is a mock fight, a sham, un simulacrum, right? A simulacrum of a fight. And if anybody of importance, the king or any lord, if anyone is near, then the people honor them with their presence. And all of the young people, all of the young members of the houses of the nobility, of the bishops, of the barons, of the earls. Remember that earl in English is conde. El equivalente de conde is earl. All of the younger men, who, of course, have not yet been dignified with the honor of becoming a knight, however, are desirous of testing their skills. And yes, you have the victorious people and the people who envy them, right? Victory leads to emulation. That's what they say. And the horses as well, they are neighing, relinchando, right? They are neighing and in their eagerness to charge. And when the joust begins, the combatants are divided into parties. One body, one group, withdraws. One of them retreats. One of them leaves the field, while the other pursues, the other attacks. And then the pursuers overtake the force. And then it goes around and around, taking turns. And so all of this was considered the best form of entertainment at that time. Now, the fact is that these jousts were not exactly harmless. There are many people who came back from combat, who came back from the Crusades, only to be killed in these tournaments. However, this was considered a noble way to die, part of this courtly love that we call chivalry. I think on another program I'm going to talk about chivalry and what it involved. Now, again, these wars, these constant wars, with the effect of chivalry, with the connections that chivalry caused, with the imposition of feudalism, it was possible for these people to stop fighting each other. With the central authority, the Pope, the King, the Holy Roman Emperor, it was possible to impose peace on these people and prevent them from killing each other the way they had been before. However, as I said, it was going to be necessary for them to do something other than these tournaments, these jousts, to pass their time. And that was one of the main reasons for the Crusades, so that you could get these people out of the country, away, somewhere else, where they really could fight. All right, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Juego de la vida exige unos elementos que son básicos. Nosotros respondemos cuando a su vez nos sentimos respondidos. Por eso más nos dan, más ganas tenemos de dar. Por eso es una limitación inmensa tratar el trabajo como una realidad meramente transaccional. Es decir, si yo cambio horas de mi vida por un determinado dinero, sea mucho o sea poco, habitualmente es poco, pues no me sentiré con ganas de aportar nada más. Por eso las empresas tienen que ser algo más que un lugar donde se compra tiempo de vida a cambio de unos euros. Tienen que ser un proyecto.
No siempre es fácil poner en marcha un nuevo proyecto, y menos aún alcanzar el éxito como líder de equipos. Si quieres descubrir las claves del éxito de la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado, no te pierdas las dos nuevas convocatorias del seminario Emprender y Liderar, las claves del éxito. El jueves 27 de septiembre o el jueves 25 de octubre.